Before I really knew his name, he looked so much like his sister, whom I used to know in Lawrence County before I left there. I'm pleased to be here. Am I right for you? Well, if I put my hand on this, do I drown myself out? I'm pleased to be here, and I'm especially pleased with the effort of the people interested in history here in getting a really fine historical society organized and going. All of our counties need these, and you are, apparently are ahead of the pack in organizing one here. Especially do we need them in the mountain counties, because we are the nursery basket for the rest of the country. And if you know anything at all about your family history, you're likely to be overwhelmed with the communication from people who live on the West Coast and between here and there who now want to identify themselves, who want to trace their ancestors back. Often they have false notions. They get out on the West Coast, they think that they were from the South, meaning that they lived in palace-like places with tall white pillars in front of them and the like. I had two such letters last year from somebody in Oregon. I didn't let them know that their ancestors that I knew, who were most honorable people, lived in log cabins. This would have been a great disappointment to them, because they were expecting to get another image. We need to be prepared for those people, and we need our local societies, and I commend the people in Johnson County and recommend that effort to all of you. I have prepared a paper tonight, which I have practiced reading so that I could look at it from time to time and still hold on a manuscript, because if I stray away from it too much at my age, I'm inclined to talk too long. And I will stray occasionally, but I want to hold myself pretty close to the paper. The Scotch-Irish in Southern Appalachia is the title of the paper. There are many, many more Scotch-Irish among us than typically we are inclined to think. For some reason or another, the people of Eastern Kentucky have been especially zealous to identify with English background. Unfortunately, there's very little of it. Very little of it, and such as exists is probably not what you really ought to be proud of. We are mostly Scotch-Irish and German and Huguenot and Welsh, and only occasionally English. My paper. During the 1730s, Scotch-Irish migrants began moving out of Pennsylvania and down the Valley of Virginia in great numbers. Finding good valley land already taken up by German settlers who had preceded them by a few years, they established homes up the creeks and in the coves, where they tended to live until they had outgrown the capability of their holdings to sustain them, and then move on, mostly toward North Carolina, though, and that's very significant to us, though there was a migration across the mountains into what was to become Monroe and Lewis counties, West Virginia, and another into Western Virginia in the region centering around what we now know as Castlewood. For it was from these side migrations that many of our ancestors came, if not most of them. By 1753, Scotch-Irish migrants, many of them grandsons of first comers to America, were pouring by the thousands through the dark hollow, a gap in the mountains near Mount Airy, into Piedmont, North Carolina. Matthew Rowan, pronounced Ryan in this state, commander-in-chief of the province of North Carolina, reported in that year that there were at least 3,000 fighting men in the province. Now, that was quite a number in those days. For the most part, he said, Irish Protestants, for they were not then called Scotch-Irish, and Germans, and daily increasing. 12 years later, the governor of the colony of North Carolina, Tryon, reported that in that one year, over 1,000 immigrant wagons had passed through Salisbury, the center from which the migrants spoke out, as from the hub of a wheel, in search of lands lying in the upper Piedmont and in the hills east of the Blue Ridge. Now, these people were mostly Scots-Irish. It has been estimated that from 1720 to 1776, Scots-Irish came to the colonies, quotes, on the average of 12,000 a year, or 600,000 before the Revolution. Now, that has been debated by other scholars who say there might have been 600,000 Scots-Irish here at the time of the Revolution, but not more than 200,000 of them had actually come over, meaning that they had multiplied from 1720 to 1775 while they were already here. More than 30,000 came by boat, however, in 1773 and 1774, bringing the total at the time the American Revolution began of the population of the colonies to about 600,000. Now, our total population at that time is only 3.5 million. 600,000, then, means one of every five or six persons, one would have met in the colonies at the time the Revolution began, would have been a Scotch-Irishman who had arrived so recently that he was not yet assimilated and who had not lived in any one place in America yet to have established a loyalty to it. Incidentally, by that time, they had come in such overwhelming numbers that they were no longer considered interesting people. They were beginning to be disliked, as we always dislike the second generation of migrants. The first ones were curiosities. And then when they come a little later, they begin to smell bad. They talk funny. And we make jokes at their expense. And we've done that consistently, right, straight through. We did that to the Scotch-Irish. Later on, we transferred all that to the mountaineers. And we're the only significant subculture left at which it's safe to laugh. And that doesn't bother us much because we laugh at ourselves. I enjoy Snuffy Smith as much as anybody does. And yet Snuffy Smith is to laugh at me. By 1760, upwards of 40,000 Scotch-Irish had settled on the Cape Fear River in North Carolina and in the Carolina uplands. On the eve of the Revolution, one-third of the population of Pennsylvania was Scotch-Irish. 75,000 were living in Virginia, mostly west of Richmond, and 110,000 were living in the Carolina uplands, west of Salisbury, and in general Columbia, South Carolina. That's they were the dominating population through those regions. Now, the Watauga settlements, to become later the state of Frankland and then of Franklin, with John Sevier as president, as you know, that was the first English-speaking independent political entity out on the border on the other side of the mountains, before the rest of the nation became independent. That began with just a few hundred people in 1772, but reached a population of about 25,000 in 1788, when it collapsed and was later subsumed in Tennessee. Records of the church membership at the time of the demise of the state of Franklin reveal that the people living there were predominantly Presbyterian, but with a small number of Baptists, mostly separate Baptists and General Baptists at that time, and an even smaller number of Methodists among them. That they were mostly Scotch-Irish, even though many of the family names are of English, Welsh, and French origin, is the view held by many historians. It is said that 23,500 of those 25,000 people were members of Presbyterian congregations, meaning that was almost solidly Scotch-Irish. Settlements of whites west of the crest of the Blue Ridge was forbidden by treaties prior to 1783. The thrust into Watauga and on into Kentucky prior to that time was in violation of the treaties, but the pressure of the Scotch-Irish migrants for lands, especially following their defeat That's an integral part of the Regulator Movement, 1765 to 1771. In the Battle of Alamance in 1771 was great, and they outnumbered all others in the early movement of settlers into what was to become Tennessee and Kentucky. Not having yet been assimilated into the culture of colonial Virginia and the Carolinas, the newly arrived Scotch-Irish did not feel deep loyalty to the colonies, nor for that matter, America generally. Having been treated shabbily by the British for centuries, they felt no deep love for the king. Incidentally, may I step aside just at this moment to make something perfectly clear to everyone. Not everyone understands what Scotch-Irish means. There are many who think that Scotch-Irish means partly Scotch or Scottish and partly Irish. It doesn't mean either of that. For the Scotch-Irish were neither Irish nor Scottish in the true sense of the word. They were lowland Scots. And the Highland Scots would not admit that those people were Scots at all. They were from the Celtic fringe. They were the old Celts of the generation of the type that you read about when you read the King Arthur stories. They were a people unto themselves that don't even look like the other people. Now, these people, having been driven into that border country between Scotland and England, beginning with the invasion of Julius Caesar before the birth of Christ, had been treated shabbily throughout their history from that point on. They were mistreated by both the Highland Scots and by the British to the south. And they had no love for the British. No good reason to love the British at all. It was the Scotch-Irish of the uplands and the colonies who engaged the British armies at Cowkins and King's Mountain and Guilford Courthouse, and who drove the army of Cornwallis toward Yorktown, where he surrendered a year later. It was they who turned the tide that led ultimately to victory, independence, and a new nation. In other words, it was our ancestors who won the revolution and who established America. And those of us who grew up in homes in which ancestry was still being taught are probably not unfamiliar with the story that one of my ancestors signed the Declaration of Independence. So you were in school, you get all eager and excited about that, and you find a copy of the Declaration of Independence and the name's not there. Well, you don't understand. My people are great liars, you say. Not at all. They signed the Watauga petitions, or they signed the Declaration at Mecklenburg, or they signed one of the declarations in Western Virginia. Declarations that took place before the declaration was ever made. And because that happened, then has a special aura of significance to it. But these people were radicals. They were out front. They were troublemakers. They were leaders. And following the revolution, and of course these people, when they understood the issues, joined the patriot armies in overwhelming numbers. Following the revolution and the ceding by Virginia and the Carolinas of their western lands to the new national government, it became possible for veterans of the war to claim for their military service land warranties in the mountain country west of the Blue Ridge. By the end of the 1780s, they were moving into the mountains by the thousands. Not many outside the Watauga settlements around Jonesboro, Tennessee, and in the central Kentucky, both of which were settled illegally, of course. Not many people were living in the region, except in those communities, until the issues were settled following 1783, and it took a little while to get everything cranked up so the old soldiers could claim their land. There is evidence to support the claim that at least three of every five to take up land in the mountains were Scotch-Irish, among whom were many with Huguenot, Welsh, and English names, but who had either come themselves directly from Ulster or were sons or grandsons of those who had. For those who had resettled Ulster about the time Jamestown was being settled had come out of lowland Scotland and the northern counties of England. Very few people from southern England went. Consequently, one may find even families in Appalachia with Welsh names who will tell you they're Scotch-Irish. And the story is this: you go back into the hollows where the old patriarch lives, and you say to him, "Now, tell me about who your people were." And he will fall back in. He might still speak the Appalachian dialect. We made so much fun of it, you know, that almost everybody stopped speaking it now. And he'll say, "Well, sir, you see, we was Irish." Now, in that dialect, was singular plural, were was always subjunctive. "We was Irish," which meant Scotch-Irish. For when they came, the word Scotch-Irish was not being used. "And they was three brothers." That "they," spelled T-H-E with a slant on it, has nothing whatever to do with T-H-E-Y. It means "there," as it's always meant, "there." It meant that in the northern dialect. It still means that in Appalachian dialect. "They was three brothers." Always. And when he gets to that point, you know he's telling you folklore. Always "they was three brothers." And "they" comes to Pennsylvania. And one comes to Virginia and all over here. And the other stayed in Pennsylvania. We never did know what happened to the other. This is the typical story. But almost all of them will tell you that "they was Irish," which meant Scotch-Irish. There's evidence to support this claim, of course, if we look about. In spite of the name, by the time that they were migrating from Ulster, those who had come, the Huguenots, who had come over to help them with their textile industries, which became the finest in the world, had their names anglicized. And they came into Appalachia thinking of themselves not as Huguenots, but as Scotch-Irish. They were Cornets now, not Cornet. And Arnets, not Arnett. And Birkett or Birchett, not Birkett. And many of those bearing what have been Welsh names were identifying themselves as Irish also. Even Evans's and Griffiths and Jones's and Taylor's and Davies and Davis, all Welsh names. Or they changed the name of their spelling. The spelling of their names. So that Bleven, B-L-E-T-H-E, became Blevins. That name, spelled Blevins, doesn't exist in the British Isles at all. One would still find Blevin occasionally. And Gemmell became Gamble, a name that we're familiar with. Those of English origin to come as pioneers into the mountains lacked the homogeneity that the Scotch-Irish had approached after five or more generations in Ulster. Now let's think of that a moment. Many of these Ulsterites, these so-called Scotch-Irish, when they came to America, the families had been living in Ulster so long that they had forgotten their Scottish, lowland Scottish ancestors. We have lived in Appalachia, only five, but depending on your age. My generation, six generations. It would be like my going somewhere and trying to identify myself. The only thing I could say would be that I'm an Appalachian person after six generations here. These people then were calling themselves Irish, and that was not a good label, for they were not Irish at all. And that led to a label that doesn't really describe them. They're really Anglo-Celts, not Scotch-Irish. But that name never did catch on with them. Now the Germans, who constituted up to 25% of the pioneers in western North Carolina and represented a rather high percentage elsewhere, were in time to surrender their language and much of their culture for the old-fashioned dialect of the Scotch-Irish people and for Scotch-Irish culture. And in many instances, they translated their German names into English names, so that Zimmerman became Carpenter and Bieber became Beaver. and Weber and Weber became Weaver, and Swartz became Black, and Klein became Little or Small, and the like. The Scotch-Irish, who had not been assimilated themselves into the society of the South, tended in Appalachia to assimilate into their essentially transplanted culture, their German and English neighbors. We have very few German words in Scotch-Irish dialect, in the Appalachian dialect, in spite of the fact that almost every Appalachian family will have some German ancestors. Sauerkraut's about the only one I can think of. And in my own community, we did say, he's blind, he can't see his eye. I don't know how widespread that word is, but you can see at once that that's stein, and it means stone. But he's so blind he can't see the stones in his pathway. A German word. I had wondered whether the word Salter would have been German, sounds as if it were. But so far as I'm able to tell, that's not. It's a genuine Scotch-Irish word. How many know what a Salter is? Well, there's a Salter festival in Surrey County, North Carolina. You know what is it? No? Close, yes. It's a cobbler. It's a pot pie. And then when I was growing up near Blaine, everybody ate Saunders. But we crossed Dry Weed Ridge coming toward Louisa. Nobody ever heard of Saunders from there on east. Isn't that interesting? Very few of these German words are left. And it's worth some further study, really. I can think of only two German words. And one of those is Beelobo, its use. And yet, I myself had an ancestor five generations back, a German, who died at the age of 102 and who never spoke English in her life, according to family stories. Now, when the Scotch-Irish came, and this is something we've been sensitive about, because we went through periods, especially during the last 100 years, when all the educators were doing everything they could to make us ashamed of being Appalachians. The whole educational process was directed at that. Now, during that time, we learned to be ashamed of a lot that we didn't need to be ashamed of at all. One of them was the fact that we could hear and talk to the old-timers and our families that first had come over as redemptioners. They were bondsmen. In fact, in my community, there's a fragment of a song. Must I go bound? Must I go free? Bound me. Well, the Scotch-Irish almost without exception came as redemptioners, as indentured servants. It was not disgraceful in those days, for they were very poor. But in spite of that, they were the best educated large mass of immigrants to reach the American shores after the arrival of the Puritans in New England. This is little known. This does not support the stereotypical picture of the Appalachian people. We're supposed to be stinking. Our gene pools are supposed to be depleted. We're supposed to be guilty of incest. We drink whiskey and moonshine and do everything in the book that's ugly, and anything that gives the picture to us as any other kind of person must be wrong historically, has been the position. We're just now getting that correct. And may I say to you, there is nothing wrong with our ancestors having come as redemptioners, for they were indeed poor. The British government had promised them all those things. They built those marvelous textile mills, and then the London merchants had used their influence to have taxes passed to kill them. And so by the time they started moving over in 1720, they were quite poor. But they were well educated. For in New England, in Ulster, they had set up schools to which both boys and girls went. That was an innovation. Elsewhere in the world, only boys went to school. And when they came, both men and women could read, and many of them were university graduates. As they took up holdings in Appalachia, they established schools for their children and built Presbyterian churches. Family histories recount how first settlers built log schools near their homes for their children and for the children of their neighbors. I read a history last year of the Gamble family, which had its seat in the bend of the Blue Ridge. The bend of the New River in the Blue Ridge, that part of the Blue Ridge of the New River that became a wild and scenic river by act of Congress a year or two ago. The first thing Martin Gamble did after his youngins, that's an Anglo-Saxon word, we still use it in Appalachia, after his youngins began to arrive, was to build a schoolhouse on his lands, to which all the other children in the community could come as they wished. And that schoolhouse stood there until the 1930s, and carved on the wood log walls were the names of all those who had gone to school when the things tore down. I read two or three other family histories that the Appalachians are now beginning to write their histories, in which similar accounts are given. We came into the mountains, sensitive to education, we were educated, both men and women, and we kept education alive for a long time. Many travelers through the Appalachian region referred to the educational status of those who were living there. François-André Michaud reported in 1802 that schools had been established at the expense of the inhabitants as soon as the population was dense enough to warrant them. Children were sent punctually to school throughout Kentucky and Tennessee to learn reading, writing, and arithmetic, three R's. Quote, it is therefore very uncommon to meet with an American in the backwoods, who is unable to read and write, Michaud reported. Adam Hodgson, a Liverpool merchant, crossed Appalachia in 1820, 18 years later. In North Georgia, he ate breakfast in the home of an intelligent farmer, quote, whose wife was a half-breed Cherokee, and whose children were well-behaved and better educated than those of many of our respectable farmers, quotes. That is, our respectable farmers than British. Note that this Scotch-Irishman had married a Cherokee wife, and this is true of many Scotch-Irish people. They married easily outside themselves. The only requirement was that anyone who married a Scotch-Irishman had to become a Scotch-Irishman. But Scotch-Irish people were leather-headed, uncompromising people who were just as sure as anything that they were as good as anybody and better than most people, especially those who lived up the creek ways. And yet, they evaluated everybody in terms of personal worth. It didn't matter what the background was. If the person were worthy, then he was always well. And there's still much of that prevailing among us, I think. Among the books on the shelves of the library in this home of the man who had the Cherokee wife, he found The Spectator. People who are acquainted with English literature know what that means, and a copy of the Bible and the hymn book and periodical publications of one kind or another. He spent that night in the home at the foot of Lookout Mountain of another Highlander, that is, an Appalachian person, who lived very much like a gentleman.